This podcast is brought to you by Electric Power Systems. EPS is a leading provider of high-power, scalable powertrains that are certifiable for electrified aviation. It develops energy storage systems, DC fast charging stations, and electric propulsion products for aerospace, defense, automotive, marine, and industrial traction industries. Welcome back, listeners, to the Aviation Renaissance with Spencer and Spencer here. We have a great guest. And I'm going to butcher your title here, Dave, but it is the Director of Product Management of Infrastructure, is that
it? Yeah, Senior Director of Product Infrastructure.
Product Infrastructure. So that's who we have on today, David Koch. So go ahead and tell the listeners about who you are.
Great. Well, I'm glad to be here with Spencer and Spencer, the soon-to-be famous podcast.
Already famous. Already famous. Not publicly, just...
Infamous, I think, would be more appropriate.
Internally infamous, right?
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit on my background. So I grew up an Idaho farm boy. Wow. Grew up in a small rural Idaho town working on dairy farms and chicken farms. Decided to study engineering. Got my mechanical engineering degree with an aerospace emphasis. And had big aspirations of working in space and aerospace. And first job out of college... I was a finite element analyst for the Trident nuclear submarine third stage nozzle.
A what? Finite element
analyst.
Analyst. Explain that, please.
I just was letting him go.
I kind of want to know what that is.
FEA is an analytical tool for just predicting mechanical stress and thermal loads and stuff like that.
Okay.
Really cool job, aerospace. But it was a lot of government contract work, which became pretty bureaucratic and not quite as exciting as I originally thought. So I went back and got an MBA at Purdue University. Met my wife there. My wife studied engineering there. I studied business there. She actually has a better engineering degree than I do.
we won't tell our listeners that.
Okay.
Just
And then we've been married for... for 20 years now, four great kids, two girls, two boys, ranging between the ages of 14 and 21. And so I'm feeling a little bit old now on the cusp of having the kids out of the house. But my career then took a turn after my MBA. I ended up spending a portion of my career in the electronics device industry, working for a company that built removable storage and MP3 players. And,
oh, sure.
Oh, wow.
So I worked as mechanical engineering doing that. Really enjoyed it, but it was a little bit up and down. And ended up transitioning into, of all things, medical devices. So I spent 15 years of my career developing spine implants and managing teams that develop spine implants. Before I came to... EP Systems, I was vice president of engineering for a spine startup company that was transitioning their technology, trying to sell it, spin it off, sell it to a big medical device company. And I was looking for some more stability, kind of talked to a few people. I knew Nate Millican, founder of the company, co-founder of the company, and pinged him a little bit, and we started talking, and one thing led to another. I ended up at Electric Power Systems. That was about 3 years ago. So it was quite a departure from where my career was going with 15 years in medical device, but in some respects, coming back to where I started in aerospace.
Yeah.
And so it's been exciting, and I think the thing that really appealed to me, or the thing that kind of closed the deal with me transitioning over to Electric Power Systems was the company, the culture, and the opportunities at the company. I could see, 3 years ago, the company was in an incredible growth phase, as it continues to be. Mm-hmm. But the company has the right technology at the right time. Mm-hmm. It's on the edge of an exploding industry. Electric aviation is, as you guys know, an imminent game changer. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me when I go and look at the websites like the Vertical Flight Society, and they list 400 or 500 companies building vertical takeoff landing aircraft. I mean, it's not something that some guy in his garage is thinking, hey, this would be cool to build a flying car anymore. You know, that was 10 years ago.
That was Duffy in his basement.
Yeah. That's what Mike Duffy was doing in his basement. That was 10
years ago. Yeah. So, you know, that combined with, you know, the other thing too is the energy density, right? Energy density has finally gotten to a point where you can do meaningful flight. And the thing that is, you know, everybody's excited about building an aircraft, 500 plus companies trying to build something that flies electrically. Nobody's really taken a step back and saying, who's going to provide the power systems, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're behind the aviation industry. There's, you know, if you look at the general aviation industry, there's the Airbus and the Boeings and the Embraers. Those are the big names, you know, but you don't necessarily know all the people that make those engines and the power systems and the components that go into building those aircraft. And that's where EP Systems is. We are at the forefront of the power systems, propulsion, electric propulsion systems. And, you know, we're in pole position. There's really nobody on Earth that makes a better electric propulsion system for aviation and electric power systems does today. So that's really what drew me to the company. Yeah. That opportunity and the opportunity to be involved in something exciting and that will change aviation.
So you said that electric aviation is imminent, but I think I might take it a step further and say it's inevitable.
Yeah.
It's going to happen.
Yeah. It's interesting because you talk to people. I had a funny conversation the other day with a guy I know who still is not convinced that electric vehicles are imminent.
And does he not watch the Super Bowl commercials?
Well, I don't know what he, you know, what he's been exposed to or what he knows, but you know, if you go out and buy an electric car, especially where we are today, and we're in 5 years, you're either gonna have to make the decision to buy a car that is more expensive, more complicated, requires more service, doesn't have as good of acceleration, costs more to run. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to say, okay, this is the future. And the same reasons apply to electric aviation. Mm-hmm. You know, you can go through the list. You know, in the future, you know, once the two big deterrents, range and infrastructure are solved. Mm-hmm. I'll talk a little bit more about infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Then you're going to be sitting in the same scenario, right?
Right.
Is, do I want to buy something that's less reliable, you know, more risk, worse for the environment, cost me more to run? The answer is no. I'm going to buy an electric aircraft.
Right.
And so, you know, as the technology comes online and the range is extended, that's going to be a game changer.
So you just brought it up, but so going to infrastructure, so that's in your title. A lot of people don't know infrastructure in generalities related to electrification. What is the future of infrastructure? Let's go back. Let's define what the infrastructure is for electric aviation and where are we at in terms of the infrastructure?
Yeah, so the only electric aircraft that exists today is the Pipistrel electric aircraft that are at least certified in Europe. And they have, they've kind of had infrastructure as a sidebar. They have ability to charge. They don't fast charge necessarily. And that needs to be solved. That's a big hurdle for the industry. So in the coming years, when all these electric aircraft and eVTOLs start rolling off the production line, the operators are going to be faced with the question of, well, if I buy this aircraft, I can't just use my existing infrastructure, my gas truck and the stuff I have. I got to add new infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And it's not insignificant. So you know, the thing you really need to operate commercially in a flight school or in a advanced air mobility, urban air mobility type scenarios, you need to be able to turn your aircraft asset around in 20-30 minutes. 20-30 minutes, yeah.
Hence the fast charging reason.
Right. Yeah. And so the charging infrastructure exists. And a lot of this pathway has been paved by heavy industry charging infrastructure. So semi-trucks and buses and a lot of, you know, even farm vehicles that are, you know, John Deere is working on these fast charging solutions. That electronic infrastructure, the electric power infrastructure, can be converted over and put onto tarmacs and or onto ramps and hangers. But it does require, in some instances, significant investment just for running high power lines, putting transformers in place, and then putting the distribution boxes out there for the charging systems. Mm. But, you know, initially, you know, we as a company will offer DC fast charging, you know, 150, 200 kilowatt DC fast chargers that will turn around a fixed wing single engine aircraft in 20, 30 minutes. So this will be, you know, for flight schools that want to keep their assets moving in the same paced operation as they currently have with an IC engine fleet. But that's what I'm working on. We have some exciting opportunities to work with potential partners on that and to bring that to market and put that infrastructure in place. But it's like electric vehicles. It's going to be a little bit of a stepwise approach. The difference between aviation and electric vehicles is we don't have to have charging stations on all highways in all towns. You can do targeted, right? We can have electrification airports, which is a much more discreet, much more limited infrastructure rollout than you need to have if you're trying to electrify the whole roadway system of the United States, for example.
Right, right.
I'm glad you brought that up because that was something I was going to ask you about. So if we look at Tesla and what they're doing in their Charge Across America, if you get on a map and you look at, say, I-90, they're wanting to put a fast charge station pretty much at every rest stop. So you're talking about doing a quick turnaround, 20 to 30 minutes. Is that fully charged? Because I know if you go to a fast charge station for Tesla, 15, 20 minutes only gets you 80%. Mm-hmm. So is that 20 minutes going to be a full charge, or is it going to be an 80% charge like an electric vehicle?
Yeah, good question. So we're our goal is to have turnaround in 20 to 30 minutes for next flight. So if that's 90% or 95% or 100%, you're familiar with charging. You know that when the last bit of the charging takes longer to do, right?
Right.
So that's a good question. I don't know that we are targeting, you know, 99, 100%, but we do want to have the asset to a state of charge where the next useful flight can take place. And I don't think that necessarily has to be topped off at 100. It could be something close to that.
Well, you're currently in flight school right now, correct?
Correct.
So depending on what your flight is, you would not need 100% charge, depending on what your flight for that day is, correct?
Right.
That's good to know. I had another question. So California just put out that they want to have all ICEs, which are internal combustion engines, for our listeners, done by 2030. No more in place. Do you see that happening with the aviation industry at some point in the future?
I think so. I think as the technology permits, you know, large commuter jets were a long ways away from having electric, all electric versions of that, obviously. But hybrid and you know, more environmentally friendly solutions will definitely be pushed by not only the industry but government regulators. We see that big pushes in Europe, and I think correspondingly that's going to be a nice benefit for the industry in the adoption, in the sense that there will be government funding to help put infrastructure in place, just like you see government funding and tax incentives for electric vehicles. You know, there are, you go from state and federal location to location, and you'll find funding for charging infrastructures, putting charges in places, or supercharge stations. You'll find tax incentives for people who purchase a vehicle that's an electric vehicle. Mm-hmm. You know, historically, there have been a lot of those. Mm-hmm. There are governments who are interested in being first to electric aviation, state governments. We're working with state governments to try and build out that infrastructure and plan. We have, we're actually involved in some government contracts and FAA contracts to plan that out and provide information and resources and analysis into how that all rolls out and how we can collaborate. And we have partners, you know, corporate partners in the industry that we're working with to approach different state and federal agencies and legislative bodies to try and accelerate that. Let them know what we need as an industry and how to get there.
So you're bringing up the next part of infrastructure because, so the government, right? What incentives is it for a government to want to get schools to go electric? You know, if I were a government, David, let's say I'm a government and say, why should I give you money to make EP systems infrastructure in my regional airports?
That's a good question. I think it comes back to the same incentives that operators have potentially. You know, reduced costs. Reduced costs leads to increased volumes. You know, you can, if you have a 20% reduction in the cost of your flight schools, you could potentially offer 20% more flight training for the same price. One really compelling thing on the horizon is the urban air mobility, mm-hmm. right? Urban air mobility opens up doorways that don't exist for rural communities, for urban communities, for transportation, for where people live, how people work, the way people interact with each other. Mm-hmm. And it opens up economic opportunities for a state or, you know, even a federal government to be at the forefront of that. And so I think those are the things that become interesting for a governmental body to help incent them to subsidize electric aviation.
I think on the converse side of that, the private industry, now if you have the infrastructure that the government has helped and sees a benefit from it, we're in Logan, Utah. There's a very small airport here. Salt Lake City is the closest major airport, but if the infrastructure at Salt Lake City is in place for electric air vehicles and in Logan, it opens up a massive opportunity for people that may live in the valley down by Salt Lake to work in Logan, because now they can go, instead of having to make that long hour and a half, 2 hour drive, they can go to the airport, hop on an electric plane, and fly to Logan in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what you were talking about connecting people together in a way that we're not connected right now.
Exactly. And I think it'll start out and it'll be limited by range.
Right.
It'll be limited by, you know, I can fly, you know, 60 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So where can I get in 60 minutes with an energy reserve? And so you'll look at the population bases. You may be looking at, greater Los Angeles area, for example. But as that range increases, and if you look at the expansion of energy density of lithium ion over the years, it expands on average 4 or 5% per year.
Mm-hmm.
And so you propagate that out, and you know, by the time a lot of these planes have come online and started to become mainstream, the energy densities of those batteries are going to enable the aircraft to travel 30, 40, 50% longer. And now you open up more opportunities, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you get from Logan to Salt Lake? That would be awesome, right? We would all appreciate that because now we don't have to
drive
an hour and a half to get to the airport, right? I take a short flight.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, the other thing that drives the business model is the economics of electric flight. It's just less complicated. It's cheaper, and
it's not as noisy.
Yeah. I mean, theoretically, I could take a helicopter from Logan to Salt Lake right now, right? if I had the,
yeah, you could,
the wherewithal. But you know, having that become affordable for the average traveler is what will enable the market to grow.
So as far as infrastructure, I mean, there's many hurdles that come along with electrifying aviation. And there's hurdles that come along with the infrastructure being put in place. What do you see the biggest hurdle is, infrastructure-wise, to make this happen?
The biggest is, that's a good question. I don't think from the regulatory side that it's too cumbersome. There is a fair amount of work that needs to take place, you know, with the airport authorities and with the FAA and, mm-hmm. and getting the infrastructure on site. But I think that's fairly manageable. I think the biggest hurdle for most operators is going to be the initial infrastructure cost. Mm-hmm. It's going to be an unexpected expense. And when they're weighing, do I add another IC engine aircraft to my fleet or do I add an electric? If I choose the electric, the first time I choose the electric, I've got to take on this extra bill of putting the chargers in place and maybe laying wire and, you know, cable for the charger. So I think that will be something that will be a challenge for some operators. I think the more that the governments and can step up and offer some support and grants and maybe tax incentives to where the operator can recoup most or all of that sooner. I mean, the operator will recoup that cost over time anyway, just because they're flying an asset that costs them less to fly. But having the capital expenditure to put that in place in the first installation will be a bit of a hurdle.
But I mean, to your point, it's not only an imminent industry change, but it's inevitable, right? So I'm sure our sales pitches, we're not just going in there and say, yeah, it's going to be $2 million. And they kind of balk at that, but kind of the sales pitch is, well, this is going to happen any way you'd like. So do you want to do it now or do you want to do it later? So, you know, understanding that point, where is EP Systems at right now in terms of, you know, we don't have to say pilot customers, but where are we at right now with the infrastructure we're going to provide for our Epic Systems?
So that's a good question. And I think one thing we would like to do as a company is we would like to explore options with potential operators and potential customers to provide energy as a service, which mm-hmm. enables us to then provide the customer with that infrastructure. They don't have to come to the table with that cash outlay.
Right.
They can essentially start saving money day one.
Oof. Like it.
Don't have to have the capital outlay. And then we add an incremental fee mm-hmm. to the energy as a service. We provide energy as a service. So we have a service contract where we would then recoup our return on investment over time. And that would help facilitate especially some of the smaller operators, some of the smaller flight schools or people that want to maybe set up a vertiport, then allow them to get there quicker if they didn't have the capital wherewithal to do that.
Hmm.
It's interesting. I want to go back to the very beginning here.
Very beginning.
Okay. Yes. Just because I like to talk about work and I like to talk about the future of aviation, but I also like to get to know the people that come in here and talk to us. We see each other at work every day, mm-hmm. but we really don't have an opportunity to sit down and talk personal kind of stuff. So small town, Idaho.
Yeah,
what small town in Idaho?
I grew up in Preston, Idaho.
Ooh.
If you want to have a comprehensive review of my childhood, go watch the movie Napoleon Dynamite. that was filmed in my hometown.
Yes.
I worked on the chicken farm in that movie.
Okay.
My locker from high school is that movie. That's
whoa. You worked, because I know in Preston, the chicken coops are like the thing, right? Doesn't yeah. everybody have to work at the chicken coops in Preston?
I don't know that everybody has to work at the chicken coops. I felt kind of special being, you know, selected to get that job.
Oh, go take a step back. You were like, oh, it was seen as a victory to be just
yeah, my dad, I must have been 14, 15 years old. He drove me out there. He said, yes, the owner, hey, can you put my boys to work?
This is exactly like Napoleon Dynamite.
I didn't get paid in all change, but I got paid a fairly minimal wage. It was
so. Where did you get your engineering degree at? Not your MBA, but your
engineering degree from Utah State.
Okay, so that wasn't much of a culture shock for you going from Preston, Idaho, to Utah State, because it's all in the same valley.
Yeah.
How was the culture shock going from Utah State to Purdue?
You know, I think the biggest culture shock that I had when I was 14 years old, I signed up for an exchange program to Germany with our high school.
Whoa!
And
nice.
It was kind of, you know, the seniors were supposed to go, they didn't have enough. And as a freshman, I ended up over in Germany, and through a series of strange events, the senior class there ended up getting permission to take a small handful of group, a small group into East Germany, which was communist East Germany at the time. So I went from,
I'm not trying to show your age right now, but this was before 1991.
Yes, I okay. Since people can't see how old I am, how much gray
this
hair
is
I have.
Before
I should disclose. I'm pretty old. that was really a culture shock for me. Going from an Idaho farm kid to spending a week in communist East Germany, it kind of changed my world perspective a little bit. Mm. And then subsequently, you know, I've had the opportunity to, I served an LDS mission, a mission for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Austria, learned German. And then I, when I was in the medical device industry, I spent 5 years in Switzerland as an expat, doing product development on spine stuff. So living in Switzerland for 5 years helped me, reframe my view of the world and things a little bit.
Infrastructure is fascinating, but I would have never have known this about you, David, if I did not sit down and talk to you about it. And that's kind of like why we like doing this. It's very interesting.
So how long ago were you in Switzerland? How long has that been?
Oh, it's been 10 years.
10 years.
Yeah.
So you've been stateside, because I know we've talked a little bit about this, but that's three different countries that you've lived in Europe. So you're a little Preston farm boy. You end up somehow in Germany and then go to East Germany, which my generation doesn't know anything about, but if you research, you'll learn about. And then you go to Austria, which is also a very fascinating place. And then you live in Switzerland. Would you say the farm boy's kind of been knocked around a little bit, or?
You know, I am never hesitant to say I grew up as a small town farm boy.
That was the first thing you said.
I think there was a lot of things I learned about life and principles and character that I've taken with me through my career and through life.
I think that's great. So we're almost out of time here. Mm. We would like to hear your final thoughts on why EPS. Why should somebody or a company that's interested in getting into electric aviation, why should they come to Electric Power Systems as their power source provider?
So I'll address that as two questions. First, why should somebody who is interested in partnering with EPS get involved? And two, somebody that's interested in working with EPS. So
that's great, yes.
First of all, you know, right now, if you're an electric aircraft company, you're either trying to build your own power system or you've partnered with somebody, and the number of people you can partner with is pretty limited. Mm-hmm. The number of people you can partner with that have the pedigree of EP systems is zero. Mm. Nobody has built as many power system, electric aviation propulsion power systems as EP systems. You know, from our initial start building the X-57 propulsion system through the, I don't know how many it is now, 40, 50.
We're over 40 now.
Yeah, different variations. We've learned, we've broken things, we've done things wrong, we've changed them, we've gotten them right. And that's just something you don't learn overnight. That's something you learn with experience. That's something you learn with really smart people going through a learning curve. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you want to build your own system and you have some really smart people, that's great, but you're still going to have to go through some of that learning curve yourself. The other thing that is very compelling about EP Systems is we're going to be the first company with the EPIC system that has an off-the-shelf solution, right? You don't have to incur all the engineering costs of building and developing and testing and breaking and certifying your own system, because we've built a system that now can be leveraged across multiple platforms. So you will get a, if you partner with EP Systems, you'll get a better system for a lower cost. Mm. That's the reason to work with EP Systems from a customer's partnership standpoint. But when people come and interview, when I've interviewed people for positions at EP Systems, the thing I tell them is EP Systems, a year at EP Systems is like 5 years somewhere else.
You're telling me.
It's a fast-paced moving company. The growth is incredible. The people are great. You know, one thing I would say for EP Systems is we've done a really good job of hiring really good people. Mm-hmm. And people that fit the culture. You know, if you go onto the company website and you look at the company culture, the values we have are not just hanging on the wall. They're ingrained in the employees. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. I think it's, you're going to spend the majority of your day at work. You should have a place where you can enjoy working, you can thrive. It's a great place for people who want a challenge. You know, if you want to sit back and punch the clock and work at a bureaucratic company, then you should get a job as a finite element analyst. At,
there it is, right back to the beginning.
But if you're interested in something that's exciting and fast paced, and that quite frankly 5 years from now will be completely different than it is today, and you want to be involved in that change, then EP Systems is the place to go. Mm.
And if you want to be on a competitive Ultimate Frisbee League team, come to EP
Systems. I thought you were going to say competitive Ultimate Podcast.
No.
We'll go with the Frisbee.
No,
team.
Ultimate Frisbee. David Koch heads it up.
That's
true. He's our captain.
I have to put a plug in here for the EPS Ultimate Frisbee team. So we started out a couple years ago in the City League, recreation, and we struggled. By the end of last season, we were competing to be one of the top two or three teams in the competitive division.
Oof.
So
that's just good coaching right there.
That's
and good recruiting.
It's we have some good athletes.
We do. All right. This has been a great podcast. It's been great to getting to know you better, David. That's it for today. We'll have another one coming out pretty soon. If you want to know more about EP Systems, go to our website, epsenergy.com. Click on the link trees and listen to the other podcasts. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in today. This podcast was brought to you by Electric Power Systems. EPS is a leading provider of high-voltage, high-power, certifiable electric power systems for high-reliability applications. Its mission is to power transportation's electric renaissance by providing smarter, safer, more reliable, lighter, and certifiable batteries.